Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. I'm Megan Wildhood, a host on the New Books in Poetry, a part of the New Books Network. I'm back with another episode here. Gosh, we have a treat today. I'm speaking to Millicent Borges Accardi, excuse me, a Portuguese-American writer, who is the author of four poetry collections, including Only More So, published by Salmon Poetry Ireland, and Quarantine Highway by Flower Song Press. That's the one we're going to be talking about today. Among her awards are fellowships from the National Endowments for the Arts, Fulbright, Canto Mudo, Creative Capacity, the California Arts Council, Foundation for Contemporary Arts, which was a COVID grant, YADO, and the Portuguese National Cultural Foundation, as well as the Barbara Deming Foundation, Money for Women. She lives in Topanga Canyon. Thank you so much for joining me today, Millicent. I'm so excited to talk about Quarantine Highway.
Thank you for having me, Eminem.
Yeah, that's right. That's the first time that's happened, I think, which is odd. I would love for you to introduce our listeners here to Quarantine Highway by reading a poem of yours from the collection.
I'm happy to. This is actually the first poem in the collection. It sort of opens the book, and I'll get started. It's called Broken Pieces. All was if and maybe and meanwhile. The chorus sang full of weed, a reflection on the acoustics in the church. And when does it ever seem all right? When will that be again? The empirical wish of a stupid requirement for happiness, was that what it was? And they lived happily ever after is the phrase perhaps you were looking for. A timid, cool minute inside your head when you used to believe otherwise. Back in the slow, when time, it was not the new normal. And man, it's just not us. It is global and inflated. And then, you know, it is terrifying. Did they take a census this year? 2020 America. I seem to remember 10 years ago, the government wanted to know our household income and what we did for a living. This year, the form was all about age and race, and you could fill in whatever other you wanted, like a weakness, a mere description of how it was not supposed to be.
Well, that is just even better read out loud. When I read it, I read this collection twice, and this poem stood out every time. I think it is an excellent introduction to this collection that really captures so much of the early years, of the pandemic. There is a line in there where you write, back in the slow, when it was not the new normal. That really captured something for me. And it made me, like, in my head, I asked the question, what happened to time the last 4 years? What we're all, it seems like we all had a similar experience of things were going along sequentially. It was fine. The pandemic happened. And now nobody can do time normally anymore. What happened?
It is strange. It's so strange. It was like you could count on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then we were all stuck inside. And suddenly you're like, is it Friday or Saturday? And Saturday didn't seem like Saturday anymore. And Monday was not a Monday. And then you're like, gosh, it feels like March. And it's like August. And sometimes it was really slowed down. You're like, gosh, this day feels like 3 days. And then other times you miss a whole week. It was just the nature. And then that phrase, the new normal, just got, everyone kept saying it. Oh, just get used to the new normal. You can't do this. You can't do that. And so I had to put that in. So it's like you have this sort of weird, vague, slow time that we're in now, like a twilight zone. And then you have the new normal and you're supposed to get used to how things are now. And so those two juxtaposed together were my feeling during that, the quarantine time.
Totally. I feel like that captures so much, so many people's experience. Everybody I've talked to has had similar total disorientation around time. Whereas before it was like, oh yeah, we knew it was Monday in March, not August of the next year.
Exactly.
That's just, and it's still kind of happening. It's still pretty wild. And it's not like, you know, at the beginning of the year when you still write the previous year. Like, I'm still writing 2020 on stuff. That is wild. That's captured in other poems. It's actually captured throughout this collection as well. There's so much of the early quarantine life that's captured so, so well. But I think there are other inspirations of this collection too. Obviously, the experience of quarantine, which, I mean, I've tried to write about it. Lots of people have tried to write about it. This, I think, captures what I've heard from everyone. But each poem starts with a line or some capturing from another poet or another poem. And I love that. I love that so much. Did you set out to do that? Or did it just kind of come to you that way?
I didn't really set out to do anything. I was just trying to survive sort of during the period. And sure. Fair. I was struggling, as a lot of my friends were struggling. What do we write about it? Do we not? And out of the Canto Mundo Fellowship, there were a bunch of us that first year. We did the first and second year, I think. We got together online in a Google Doc, and so we did what we called a 30 by 30. And so we posted 30 poems in 30 days, and then we did it the next year. And so people would post their poems, and I got into, like, it was just kind of what I looked forward to, like that and brushing my teeth, you know? And so I would read all the poems that other people had posted. And when there was a line or something that struck me, I would start that for my next day's poem. So a lot of those lines come from poems that people were posting or poems that they were referring to. So I felt like I was part of that. That was a living, breathing document that we were all kind of working with. And so it just felt like it was the right thing to do to begin with the rest of the group. And so it was sort of like a group project in a sense. And it honored the other writers who were struggling and working with the poetry during this difficult time and strange time. So that was sort of how that came about.
Wow. I love that so much. That actually brings up another question for me that it comes up in writers groups and classes and workshops and kind of is out there. And I'm curious because I've gotten similar responses from people I've talked to about this before, but I wonder, given your experience, which is amazing, what an amazing way to form community, not just with writers now, but writers who have, you know, long since moved on from their journey on Earth, and that, you know, like there's, and if you get the book, which I highly suggest you do, you will see there are poets that most people have heard of kind of in the background of this collection. But I'm curious about how you might answer the question, is writing a solitary act?
That's, you know, I think essentially when you're there with the computer or the pen and the notebook and the paper, that part is solitary. But the inspiration and the subject matter and the time, all of that exists within a community and within a place in time. So that part is not solitary. So my answer is kind of two part. Part of the writing is very solitary and it's just you and the pen. And then, but where it comes from, it has to come from a place. You know, there's a question, does art exist in a vacuum, or is it attached to the place? And you can take poems from a couple hundred years ago, and you even if people were not intending on writing about something that was happening in the culture at the time, it's there. So you are affected, and I don't think it exists in a vacuum. And the themes and the sort of underlying subtext for the poetry and all writing, it comes from community and from the time in which you live.
Yeah, amazing. This is the whole collection really is, I think, an excellent artifact of this time, which are we out of, are we not? It's very unclear. I mean, the first 2 years of the pandemic, very distinct feeling, a little different than now. And I think there are so many lines in this collection that I think capture readers will relate to if you lived through the pandemic, which especially as an adult, the last, at least at the beginning, 2020, 2021. One of them is, it's from the poem called Bread, and you write, and then life was forbidden and everyone was an enemy. And that struck me because that was the feeling I had, and those are the words. And I didn't have the words for that, like 2020, almost all the way through 2021. And I didn't find the words for that until now. And it's so right, isn't it? Life was forbidden for our safety. And everyone was an enemy for our safety. And it's just, how did that experience impact or shift your writing in general, if it did?
Shift the writing. I think I noticed the difference with connections. Because it clearly impacted everyone who lived through it, the pandemic, the quarantine. It clearly impacted how you interact and engage and connect with other humans and other objects. And not that humans are objects, other and objects. So I think there was a sense of real fear at the very beginning when we didn't know anything. I mean, I would talk to my friends, you know, online, and we'd chat, we did a lot of Zoom things. And, you know, these are in some of the poems too. I was spraying like Lysol on the boxes. Another friend would leave boxes out in the porch or the laundry room for a week before bringing them in. So we were like all panicked because we didn't know. We didn't know if it was a railing or a wall or whatnot. And so that lack of human connection. And even now, like I find myself, I'm watching a movie. We watch a lot of movies over the Christmas holiday break. And I'm horrified, and this sounds strange to say now, but I'm horrified by some of the old movies. We were watching a lot of old Christmas movies, and there's a party and people are dancing and kissing. And the first thing in my mind is, oh my God, they're all breathing on each other. All these strangers in this room. And the one couple in this one movie, they're trying to get through the room, and it's a crowded, wonderful a holiday party. And it's like, that was my first thought. So my whole relationship with connection to other people and interaction, which is reflected in the writing as well, it's changed. It's been transformed into, so I actually look at the world in a different way. Like I look at things like, should I do them? And I've talked to other people about this as well. You look at like, what are the odds? Like, okay, 10 people outside, probably 20% chance will be good. You know, 100 people inside, about 80% chance we won't be good. But you wouldn't even think of it, you know? And another thing I was watching on a commercial or something, teenagers, they're sitting there and they pass a bottle of Coke with a straw around. Again, I'm horrified. I'm just horrified. And that is, you know, you have to feel like impacted by that, because how you are with other people in the world and in community, it's all been changed. And I don't think anyone can deny it.
Yeah, totally. It's one of the ways I've heard it talked about is this sort of collective trauma that everybody who, at least people who, well, even people who don't remember, my little niece was born in 2021. And I think, yeah, her childhood is already very different than mine, which makes me sad. She probably won't know, but you capture that sort of thing in your poem Side by Side and Fragile, and you write, a lost hope of what things used to be before the malice set in and took over like a new pleasure that used to be painful. Yeah, that's an excellent summary of the last 4 years, and especially the first 2 years, because there is something that it used to be painful to be apart. We would have to, you know, stay outside, or if you're going to be inside, stay this many feet apart, whatever. And I wasn't raised that way. I think we were all kind of used to just, you know, bumping into people as we walked around. If there was a crowded room, we would just kind of squirm around in there, and we didn't think anything of it. And then when it first started, like, no, we have to, the calculating, totally. Totally. Everybody I've talked to has done that too. Like calculating, okay, should we go to this? Can we go for this amount of time? Can we stay outside? Like that kind of thing. And it is a new sort of pleasure to be like, okay, how are we going to be as safe as possible? And I like that the phrase, the malice set in. It's not so much, it's very like the malice, not any one person is malice towards another, but just this whole thing, like everyone was an enemy, and it's still the case. And now we're looking at it, like you said, in movies retroactively, like movies that were made in the 80s or whatever. You're like, why are you all in a room together?
You have to ask yourself, like, is it worth it? You kind of weigh things, like, you know, I could go here or this. And I think that's why a lot of restaurants and department stores, it's not necessarily that we're all buying on Amazon and we like it more. It's that we're calculating the risk. Like, I could do this or that. Is it worth really stressing out? And especially if you have a difficult situation. My husband's very ill, and I deal with caregiving, and he is at risk. So it's like, if we catch any sort of the COVID, it's a real danger. So other people I know are in this situation. They're taking care of parents or grandparents, or they themselves are immunocompromised. And so just the act of being with other people or being out in the world is a calculation. Is it worth my life to go to this? Maybe a wedding of your daughter or something, that might be worth it. But going to Macy's to look at shoes, probably not. So there's this whole, like, a calculated life that we didn't have before. And I was thinking too of when I lived in Venice Beach in an old apartment that was built in the 20s, the Thornton Towers. And the apartments were really small, but we had great ocean view. My apartment was under 400, it was 350 square feet. But it had these amazing windows from floor to ceiling. And we had the furnace, you know, the steam heat. And some of the furnaces had little places where you could put bread. And then that came flooding back because of the Spanish flu. And during that time and time after, people were using steam heat with the windows open because they felt it was safer. So getting kids outside, getting them in the carriage, getting them outside, people would put their babies on the balcony to air out so they would get fresh air. That whole term about fresh air, make your kids go outside, that all came from the Spanish flu era. And it went all the way through to the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s with parents telling the kids to get outside. I'm convinced of that. And that was also a group trauma. And it was very similar. But we learned then that we didn't really know some of what we know now. but we knew that fresh air outside was better. And even then you had classes being taught in outdoor tents and you had children being shoved outside. So we learned some of the same lessons, same sort of, global trauma, but still having to do with interaction in small places with other people and very similar. But I was thinking about, that's why the windows were so big and you could open them up. And it was, I didn't realize it until we had the, you know, pandemic. I thought that's why my apartment made sense for it to be that small.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it really makes you think there, you know, that experience of the Spanish flu impacted generations. I mean, I was a child in the 80s and 90s. I was shoved outside. Get outside, get fresh air. You don't come back till the streetlights come on, all of that. And I'm not even sure if my parents would have connected it to like sickness or health or whatever. They were just like, that's what their parents told them. So that's what you do with kids. And I wonder, I'm very curious now, what is going to transmit down the generations from this, such that, you know, grandkids, kids after that, like, this is just what we do. We don't know why. We just, oh yeah, fresh air. That's just better. Of course it is.
Right.
But I don't know. I did not know that thing about the Spanish flu at all. I was just like, yeah, of course. Fresh air is better. Yeah. I grew up like that. Amazing. Yeah, it makes me think what from the COVID era is going to be passed down such that at some point it's just common knowledge and no one really knows why. Or those floor to ceiling windows. Yeah, the older buildings here have those too. And it's like, yeah, it's a beautiful view, but I don't know that that's really why they built it that way.
No, small spaces that had huge windows that my apartment was so, and the windows were just almost floor to ceiling and I could open two of them. I could fit maybe three of us like sitting on the sill in the window. That would not be done today.
Yeah, not at all. Wow. It's really amazing how we kind of ratify and solidify trauma and we don't even really mean to. We're just like, there's this line and it's talking about, it's like, oh yeah, we've learned some lessons. And then there's this other line also from Side by Side and Fragile that you write, how can we do this over and over without learning from the missteps we make? So that's also human nature, isn't it? Like, why don't we learn? Why don't we learn? And I wonder what your thoughts would be on from, you know, living through the last 4 years. What are you afraid that we aren't going to learn that we should?
I think every time we have a national kind of disaster or we have trauma, we tend to be in it and working our way through it. And then afterwards, we want to shove it down and forget it ever happened. And that cuts off the history and that cuts off what happened. And, you know, it happens that way with, you know, peoples of the world too. Once something's bad occurs, you know, we have an incident where someone is, you know, murdered or mistreated or something, everybody's all excited about it. And then it's shut down and denied. I think that denial really kills us from learning lessons and looking backwards in the history of what happens. You know, I was struck when you were talking about the lessons learned and all that on the, I think it was Seth Meyers, Colin Jost from Saturday Night Live. He was on last week, I think, or this week. See, I can't, last week, this week, who knows?
There's the time thing, yeah.
And he was talking about his grandmother recently passed away. And everyone was like, oh, and he goes, she was 106. And then he said, when the pandemic started, she called him up and she said, well, I made it through the Spanish flu. I think I can handle this one. So you have a living, breathing museum until she passed, of someone that actually experienced both in a lifetime.
Oh my gosh.
I was shocked. I'm like, his grandmother was 100. And then I was like, and she got this, and then, oh my God.
And yeah, she would have been a child, obviously. But
yeah. Like
probably. She might have been old enough to remember. Yeah. I mean, some people have memories from when they're 4 or 5.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Oh my gosh. Oh man. I feel like there are a lot of people who said that, you know, their grandparents, I also lost a grandparent in 2019, just before COVID. Well, my grandma died basically a year before COVID, but
the year
before COVID. And part of me, not that I'm glad she passed, I miss her a lot. She would be 97 in March, I think. She was born in 1926, so my math might 98. She'd be 98. Anyways, so, but I hear a lot of people say, you know, if they lost grandparents in 2019 or early 2020, they're actually grateful that they didn't have to see any of this COVID stuff. And I feel that way too, even though I'm not happy that it was my last grandparent, so I don't have any more. But I think so many people, like the last 4 years were their last memories. And I am very glad that was not my grandmother's experience at all. Because for the most part, I would say it was not great. I think that what you just talked about is we're trying to survive the thing as it's happening. And then as soon as it's over, or as soon as we think it's over, or the worst of it's over, we kind of do the flight response, where we're just like, just going to run, or freeze, where we're just, maybe that's the warping of time is related to trauma too.
Right. Fight or flight.
Right. Totally. Yeah. And so it's like, cause my question was, why don't we learn? Well, if you're traumatized, it's hard to learn, isn't it? So it's easy to sit here and go like, well, humanity, we should be learning these lessons. Why do we even have another plague? Why didn't we learn from the Spanish flu? But having gone through the last 4 years, it's like, yeah, I would prefer we just go back to normal also. Like, there's some things that I'm just like really sad about, as you write in actually several of your poems. Like, we just want it. The normal before wasn't great. I mean, it was, you know, there were a lot of problems there. And this, like, wanting to go back to that before this, like, this just malice where everyone is the enemy or could be the enemy, or leaving your boxes on the porch. We totally did that too. Or hosing down your, we would put our groceries, like all the plastic bags, in the bathtub and hose them down. I mean, we just, because we didn't know. And now I mean, I'm thinking like, okay, we probably learned that we don't necessarily need to do that. But you also said something about the risk calculation. If you are a caregiver or you share space with someone who is immunocompromised, it's the stakes are a little higher. Like, if you're, cause you're calculating the risk for two people. It's like, well, maybe I would do the thing that I wanted, that's, you know, the option of doing the thing out there, but I'm also now risking this other person, and I might be risking them more than I'm risking me. So there's an interesting, like, yes, in many ways we were socially distanced. There's the plastic things between us now. There's the masks. There's the fear that separates us all. And then there's a weird way where it tends to sort of bind people together a little bit. Like, I have to act as myself and the person I'm caring for, or the person that I share space with, or, you know, the people that I see often, or if I want to visit my grandmother, do I take this risk now? Because then I might compromise the visit with my grandmother. And that was something I didn't really realize was happening until about last year, where I was like, in some ways it strengthened connections, because it was, you did really have to think about others in your immediate proximity that, like, that you lived with, or that you were going to see a lot, or that depended on you in some way. Which, it took that long though. It took 3 years for it to be like, maybe there was something good that came out of it. Well, good poetry for sure came out of it.
I think, you know, if you have a family, community, friends, and you have empathy and compassion, I think you did think about those things.
Yeah.
Almost obviously, if you don't have those, you wouldn't think that way. My husband's a heart transplant patient, and I thought about, I mean, that's, I make reference to his being at home in a couple of the poems in a sort of vague way, but on one of the times very early when we were completely terrified, I went out and I did not know what to do, because we live in a sort of a cabin in the canyon, and it's sort of one big room. And so I was like, it'll be like on me if I bring something. And so I remember one time very early on when I'd gone out, I slept on the couch wearing two masks. And I tried to stay away from direct contact. And I said, well, and there was no real information. This is during the really, you know, sort of brutal first part where we didn't really know anything. And so I was like, you know, we were kind of discussing like, well, I'll stay away for, you know, and keep everything, all the doors and when everything open, and stay away, and I'll wear a mask, and we'll figure after maybe 2 weeks, it'll be okay. And so we kind of timed it through. And after about a week and a half, we thought, well, I haven't come down with anything. So, you know, at that time we didn't even have COVID tests. They hadn't started mailing them to. So we were being really, really careful. And so that way, you know, we thought, well, we'll be as safe as we could, as safe as possible, as we can, you know. I also wanted to point out that there's a huge disparity between the economic status of people and how it affected the pandemic. Like if you were in one economic status, you had the entitlement and the luxury to stay home and this and that. But if you were in the bottom or middle or whatnot, those were the people that were at the front line of the firing squad. You know, they were out there and delivery and all that. And there was a lot of sickness and loss. And in some cases, it divided our society up into those who could afford to live this certain kind of life. We were in fear and this and that. But we were just on the tipping point where we didn't have to go out as much as if we were forced to. And each time you make a connection, when you get a bus, you and I were talking about bus travel. every time you get a bus, there's a lot of contacts and mixed air. And if you can't afford a car, then you're on a bus, and or a train or public transportation is a different risk than driving in a car. And so there was a big schism economically with our society, as well as the compassion and empathy, those who did care and those who didn't. So the huge, huge schism that was brought forth in ways that I don't think I ever realized or ever thought would show up that way. It manifested in very strange ways.
Yes, that's a really good point. There was the staying at home in a lot of ways was definitely a luxury, because you are relying on people who could not stay home. Like the only reason you could get your groceries if you didn't want to leave the house is somebody was leaving the house to get them to you. And I think, yeah, that disparity, people, I don't think I recognized it either until it happened. It was already sort of there, and then the pandemic made it much worse. And I think that's something that hasn't been, we just really haven't talked about it as a society. I mean, there have been people like I'm in different circles and different writers, there have been people who have been writing about it. But I think as a society, that's barely been acknowledged, that like this, there were already some divisions going on. And then there's this one, the people who could stay home and the people who couldn't. And of course, there are people who, you know, maybe they had to stay home because of risk too, but there's also the conversations that we're not having around what is privilege, what is a luxury, and who really kept the society going during that, the 2 years of basically shutdown, at least in many parts of the country. I think it was different in different parts, but in a lot of parts of the country, especially the big cities, there was just a lot of shutdown. And there was a lot of, well, society still had to function. And who were the people that were keeping that Like nurses and healthcare workers, you know, got the like, oh yeah, we're the heroes. And it's like, what about the Amazon delivery people? How many times did the people that were staying at home order from Amazon and they didn't have to leave? And did they think about how did that package get to you?
Right. All the people that are in the service industry, it's almost the same. There's that, I think it's Nine Inch Nails, that the war is on the backs of the poor. Why do we always get the poor? And in wars, the poor are always drafted. Poor, underprivileged, it's always they're the ones that go. People that are middle class, a lot of times they can afford to do something else. And when you have a national trauma, it's always on the backs of the poor. So who was in the outside world on the front lines? Service people. So that included people in hospitals and nurses and doctors. It also included delivery people. It included waiters and waitresses. It included caregivers. It included everybody and bus drivers, transportation, everyone that's out there that they are serving other people. They had to get out there to work. And I mean, a lot of times in my life, I was in that role. I mean, I waited tables for a long time. And if I had been making my dollar when that hit waiting tables, like I did a while ago, a long time ago, I didn't really have an option to work remotely, you know?
Right.
But on the plus side also, where companies suddenly realized that a lot of jobs could be done remotely. And they realized just in a panic, classes could be taught online. A lot of business things where they were supporting whole office buildings and people had been begging to work from home because they had kids to take care of and stuff. And they suddenly realized if they were pushed, they could do their jobs from home. And that was maybe one of the pluses, that the world kind of opened up and in that way. So that kind of cut into people in the middle classes and it helped that and swept that in. So careers and things that were not thought of as cottage industry or I'm an IT remote worker, they weren't thought of that way. They could be. And that was kind of a breath in how the finances of industries and corporations, I think they were enlightened because of the finances, honestly. Yeah. But it sort of opened up who and what could be able to stay home in new ways. And that was a positive, I think. Also, we were able to connect in new ways through the Zoom and online and the Google Docs. And it forced us to maintain contact with our friends. It kind of forced us into, because we miss associating with people we love and people in the world. And that forced us to perhaps learn new technology and use the tools that we have in new ways. And those were good things, I think.
Yeah, that's true. It did, in many ways, it did expand access. Whereas there might've been people who didn't have access to opportunities or community because they, you know, maybe they were already living fairly remotely and they just, you know, couldn't get, or they had mobility issues, or they were already kind of shut out of a society that didn't have a lot of digital access points. And I think you're right. One of the benefits of COVID was that in some ways it did open up access to people who were already, like they before COVID wouldn't have had access, and then now they do. I mean, there are so many things I joined over Zoom that I wouldn't have heard about or wouldn't have been able to get to at all. I mean, I've joined things in other countries that I absolutely would never get to have joined, writing wise and otherwise. I never thought I'd be the person who would, you know, make friends online that I never met in person. I just don't relate to that. I know that that's the thing. That's a thing Gen Z does. I don't relate to that at all. And now I'm like, oh, I have several friends I've never met in person. Huh. How did that happen? It does make me question. I've been thinking a lot about like how the experience of the last 4 years, especially the first two of those, has affected our collective sense of home. Like not just what we do at home, because for some people it was a whole lot more than it was ever that they ever thought it would be. For some people that it actually didn't change that much. And for some, it was like, oh, I finally found a home, but it's with these people in like Europe and I'm in the United States, or Canada and I'm in Australia. And you actually write a line here. It's also from Side by Side and Fragile. It's one of my favorite poems in this collection, that you write, "Home, the place where we are drawn out and vulnerable because of our dreams and the bounds of excess joy we exude." That is an amazing line to find in the middle of this collection. The place where we're drawn out in the middle of a collection called Quarantine Highway. I love this. Talk to me about home and the sense of home. This is such a jubilant line. It grabs me every time I read it.
Well, I tried to, during that time and even now, I try to find the small joys and the goodness, even in a bad situation. So in a sense, that's my grateful, one of my lines that's grateful. and so where you kind of look outside yourself to find things, like if I go to this place, then I'll feel happy. If I travel here, when you just have the experience of just your house, you can find small joys and you can discover new things that you didn't before. So I spent a lot of times trying to find things that, like, luxuries that I wouldn't have had I had to go out and do things. And I was always like, oh, if I had time, I'd do this. And one of the things I did was I learned to knit these hats. So I would sit on the couch and I got all this yarn, which was really reasonable. And I would sit there and it would calm me down. And I knitted hats and I mailed them to some of my friends. And I made these sort of neon colored beanie hats and like winter hats and scarves. And I made a whole bunch of those. And it made me feel like I was producing something. And I leaned into the whole, like other people did, with bread, but I'd always cooked. I've always done cooking from scratch. And so I was able to have time to lean into it a little bit more. So I was able to find the small joys. And also I was able to write more because I didn't have so many other things to distract me and sort of look away from. And I didn't have other things to do as much. And like you, I was able to attend readings in New York that I wouldn't have. The Penn Center had the readings and a lot of them were free. And I was going to mention this too, AWP, the Associated Writing Programs, that year, I'm trying to think of what year it was, but anyway, in the middle of the pandemic, they actually had a conference and a lot of people got sick and maybe half the people or third showed up. And I think that was the San Antonio one. However, that made them realize that they could put all these things online. And so for the first time ever, you have people who had perhaps disabilities or were homebound or they couldn't travel or it's really expensive AWP these days. There was an option. And I was like, oh my goodness. So there was an enlightenment there. And I went to that AWP and I got to see the keynote and I did Penn. And so there were joys like that, that the world kind of opened up to us in our homes. And I don't think that a lot of these places would have been pushed to do that if it hadn't been for the pandemic. They would have just said, oh, it's too expensive, too much trouble. But when they were sort of forced into it, it was a way that a lot of people, I mean, I have some friends that just, they couldn't go to large writers' conferences for various reasons. And they were so excited that they could actually attend and you could ask questions. And it was more interactive than just reading something in a news group. So that was, and so I used to sit there and I'd do my daily poem and I'd write, and then I would look around and I would try to find small joys. And that little line in that little poem was sort of my entry point into that, looking for small joys.
Yes, I love it. And it's definitely not to discount any of the suffering that happened in the last 4 years, but there were some pretty amazing things that came out of it. Like in some ways, the world opened up even as it shut down. I remember that AWP thing. That's the first time I attended in 2019 in Portland, and I wanted to go again. And then I was like, okay, it's too far. I guess I can't. But then there was the option to do it online, and it was actually more interactive because you could chat to the people and you could make these connections. And I'm like, would this have happened if I was in person? I don't know that it would have, because you wouldn't have been able to have side conversations while you were supposed to be listening to a reading. We all lived through this monumental, obviously historic event. It did and it didn't feel historical in the moment, at least to me. I think as we're getting some distance from it, I'm like, oh, that is something that's never happened before. Like what you were saying, these huge outfits, AWP, Penn, all these things maybe wouldn't have done an online anything ever, because it's like, what's too much trouble? Technology is always a problem. We don't have enough IT staff, whatever. But if it's like hundreds of people can't go now to your conference, then you're kind of forced to. And the same with the employers. Like, oh, do we really need to rent that giant office building in the middle of downtown? Everybody hates the commute anyway. Obviously there's financial incentive there too, but it does benefit people who, yeah, they need to work from home. They've been struggling with childcare. They've been struggling with a sick loved one, all the things. And yet I still, and I felt this in reading the collection too. And there's a line that you write about this, that there were some great things that happened, attending things that I never would have been able to attend. I got to meet on Zoom, people I never would have, and am very glad that I did. There was one, a person who, you know, I've been reading he was a pastor, listening to his sermons, reading his books, years and years and years. He had a Zoom meeting with people, got to interact with them. And he actually died last year. So I was like, oh my gosh. Cause I just had it in my head, never gonna meet this guy. You know, he's in New York, all the way across the country. And then he's on Zoom. And 2 months before he died, which is like, would that have happened if it wasn't for COVID? There's that. And yet I still get the sense that I think most people knew, especially the first 2 years, that this really isn't how life is supposed to be. It's not how life was meant to be. And you write that, it's sort of a ghost in your collection. And then you say it explicitly in the poem called "Yes, It's Difficult." You write, it was simple and sweet, and maybe how life was meant to be. When we held up our wrists, someone came to pick us up and whisper, "Hush." So if it was like, it made me think, how was life supposed to be? I'd love to hear your thoughts. How was life meant to be?
Well, I thought a lot of ways that the pandemic put us back in the womb, and we were back like children. We had to ask for help, and people in positions that usually didn't have to ask for help were suddenly asking for help. And so that line was sort of about taking us back to childhood. And also when you're isolated and sort of forced to be out of the trauma, you're forced to be sort of like locked up in a small space, confined in a small space, you have a tendency to look backward. And so my husband and I, we end up talking about our childhoods a lot. And it's just the two of us, and there's not any new input coming in. So you don't really have a future. So you just go, oh, this reminds me of like fifth grade, or this reminds me of that. So you spend a lot of time reminiscing, and there's a lot of about childhood and comparing it to how it is now and in the poems as well. And I felt like it was a time of real nostalgia and going backward, because you had no new input out in the world. Your experience of out in the world was in the past. So you had that as a reference point, you know? And I was thinking about why this was different than 9/11. And it's different because it impacted all of us in sort of the same way. And it affected everyone across the board, not discounting that it financially and affected service workers and people out there, but I'm saying in a real guttural way, it affected everybody. And it sort of, equalized things. I remember when 9/11, I was working in downtown LA. I did a lot of technical writing for the oil companies. And I remember that the gas went out in my apartment and people were screaming, and I didn't have a TV then. I'm like, what happened? And I had a couple of people call me on the phone, and we were talking about it. And this was 2001. And I was like, oh my God, I have to. And I had an old TV. I got it out and I plugged it in, and I was trying to listen and see things. And I remember calling my boss at the time, and I said, I'm not coming in. The world is ending. The tower went down. And I said, I'm not coming in. And he was like, well, we have a meeting at 10. And I said, I'm not coming in. And it was very real to me, but the world had, we didn't experience it the same way. And at the time that I called, that I made the phone call, the North Tower had gone down, and there were two planes, I believe, headed from Boston to LA. And I was working at the BP Tower at the World Trade Center in Los Angeles. So I was explaining to him that it was the World Trade Center, and I was really nervous, and I'm not coming in. And it was difficult for me to put my foot down. And my husband now, at the time, he was my boyfriend, he was like, you're not going in. You're just not going. And so I didn't. But that whole experience, it didn't happen the same way. It didn't sort of flatten the line. We didn't all experience it the same way. So I think that this was a real global trauma. And I wanted to talk about something you said about artifact. I truly feel like as writers and as artists, some of our responsibility is creating artifacts of the time in which we live. And so I looked at this and I really tried to, I finished it very quickly. I'd had some other books that I'd written, and some of them took me 10 years, you know, it was like, oh my God. And so this one, I really felt strongly about it. And I really felt from the beginning, it was kind of an artifact for me and also to share with other people. And it got accepted for publication very soon after I sent it out to one of the first places. And I was just really happy to Flower Song Press, and they've been, you know, really wonderful. But the connection happened immediately, and I think it's sort of our not obligation, but in duty, in a good sense of the word, to produce artifacts of our time. And this was one of the first in my lifetime that has been sort of an equalizer across for all people.
Yeah, that's so true. I think as writers, it is our job to create artifacts. And I think we kind of do whether we mean to or not sometimes, and that might not necessarily always be good, but I think when it's intentional, like it is here, it's because gosh, everything you said was so fascinating. Like, if there's no new input, then you have no future. And it's all about the past. I wonder if that's something, that's a way that time was warped as well. It reminds me of a line you wrote in From It Made Her Feel Like, and you write, a few breaths away, it was 1992, and the world seemed to spin on my axis. And I'm like, oh my gosh, exactly. I was a child in 1992, but I remember 1992, and I have to like recalibrate that 1992 was 32 years ago. Like, 1992 is like, what? Like, that's the year my brother was born. And in my mind, he's 13 years old. No, he turned 31 last month. And I'm like, I reject this. Like, it does not compute. But it literally is a few breaths away. It was 1992. A few breaths away, it was 2004 when I graduated from high school. No, 20 years. 2004 was 20 years ago. And I'm so excited to listen to this interview again. Everything about that is so fascinating. If it's just, yeah, you were saying it's just you and your husband. Well, if there's no new input, what do you have but the past? And COVID put us back in the womb for all kinds of reasons. We're trapped in our houses, many of us, or things are closed and we can't get into places that we used to get into. And also it's just us here back in childhood. That's so fascinating. I had the feeling, but not the words until this collection. Obviously I could talk to you all day. We are closing in on the hour here. So I want to ask a couple questions, and then I would love for you to close us out with a poem. First, is there anything I didn't ask you that you wish I would have?
Oh my gosh. I just kind of let things slide as they come, and I didn't really have an agenda for what I wanted to be asked. I'll be honest, I like to have, I'm not married to expectation. You know, there's in that show, with, oh my gosh, what's her name? Angelica Houston, in the, show about, trans, and she has a bracelet, and she says, I'm not attached to outcome, or I'm not attached to results or something. And so she goes into a situation and she's like, you know, however it happens, I'm not attached to that result. So I honestly wasn't thinking. I thought I'll just see what she asked me, and I'm glad she likes my work, and we can have a talk. So I don't have anything that you didn't cover.
Amazing. That is the secret to happiness, isn't it? Do not attach to the outcome. Well, obviously, when your next book comes out, I would be happy to have you back on this podcast here. I love to get the word out about amazing collections of poetry. This is one that made me feel very seen in a time where I felt very isolated. And I think that is one thing that writers are here for, is helping people feel seen when they don't feel seen. That was kind of the point of quarantine, wasn't it? And not to be an accidental poet there. So the next important thing is, how can other people find your work, Quarantine Highway, your other collections, and more about you?
My books are available at a lot of indie bookstores, if you can look it up, and I want to support those first. They're also, I did a little search this morning, and weirdly, my book is available at Walmart and Target, and right now it's on Amazon, and when I checked, it gone down in price, which is really nice. I think at the moment it's $10.30, so it goes up and down the better how they do it. But if you have a bookstore that you frequent, the distributor has allowed my book to be available from independents and all over. So primarily you can get the information from Amazon, or you can purchase it there. I'd be deeply grateful for that, and always really like to have new readers and to exchange words and thoughts.
Yeah. Getting together with other writers. That was a brilliant idea. Sharing a Google Doc. Amazing. Yeah, I think I did a search as well. It's on bookshop.org, which is ways to support indie bookstores as well. I'm a huge, huge fan of that. And it is, as of this interview, which is right now, it's January 12th. This interview will probably air in March. But as of right now for us being January 12th, 2024, it's on bookshop.org. And is it available through the press too, Flower Song Press?
Oh, yeah, my mistake. It's also available on their website. That's probably the best place to purchase it, at Flower Song Press. Okay. They do amazing things. They also have great books, and you can sort of look through some of their other catalogs, their books there. Definitely look there first, and second, your local. Also, I think a lot of people leave out. My book is available at a lot of libraries. So I don't have a list, but I think it's available at almost 50 different libraries. So if you can check there, and if they don't have it, you can always ask for it. And a lot of times librarians never get requests like this, and they'll more than likely carry it for you. So it's right now, it's in a lot of university libraries, and local, and also international a little bit. So check your library if you want to do that. You can request it. Most libraries will, because it has a good distribution. And so independent, Flower Song, and library.
Amazing. Ask a librarian. Love it. As somebody who is starting graduate school to become a librarian next week, definitely. Yay! Do that. Next week being January 15th. And do you have a website where people find your writing?
I have a website. It's my whole complete name, Millicent Borges Accardi. com.
Okay. We will put that also in the show notes too, so that you can, you listeners can find the links there as always. So to close out, will you read a final poem for us?
I'd be happy to. Okay. This is actually the last poem in the book, Wet Was the Light. And this is from a line by Pablo Neruda. Wet was the light. Wet was the light as we saw it through a threadbare lens of what we call time, or that period of waiting between what will happen next and what we regret having happened, the hard, bad opposite of a world hunch or an omen, the silent, low sense of doom to come, a spirit arising in the country we call home, the desire for isolation, desperately to be different, the unexplored nonsense of late. This is the air in the pastel room when we are enclosed and locked up by an intense wondering and fear of comfort, fear of letting our guard down and forgetting to protect ourselves from nearly everything we can imagine. Even the scrape of skin upon our hands, the whispered hello of a neighbor or a child playing in the creek below the yard where there are dirt banks instead of lawn. We are who we choose to become, are becoming, or perhaps we mean we are who we are sentenced to be. A corona crown of in the if and now, and meant for always that time is a path to follow. As we near the day of the year when June rises her longest glance of a day and tells us it is all right to enter.
Amazing. Amazing. There's so many amazing lines, thoughts, poems in this collection, Quarantine Highway. So look in the show notes to find it at a bookstore near you. Ask your librarian for it. And stay tuned for more work. We are very much looking forward to your next collection. This is, it's such a unique voice. And I am excited to have this book in my collection now. Thank you so, so much for joining me today, Millicent, and I am truly looking forward to having you come back.
Thank you so much.
All right, readers, listeners, and writers who are tuning in, that's it for today's show, and we will see you next time on the New Books in Poetry. Take care.